Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. We are again looking at budget presentations in anticipation of putting our own budget recommendations together to deal with the deficit. Today we'll hear from the Board of Public Defense, Civil Legal Services, and the Human Rights Department Friday we will be hearing a number of bills, and that's the week. Okay, Public Defense, I don't know who, Kev, Mr. Cryer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, my name is Kevin Cuyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. Mr. Chairman, you've been passed out a handout, and I'd like to briefly go through it just to provide a little bit of background for all of you. As you recall from last year, the Board of Public Defense provides public defender services or representation in criminal cases for about 170,000 indigent Minnesotans a year. We're organized into 10 judicial districts and an appellate office. We provide constitutionally mandated services in felony, gross misdemeanor, misdemeanor, and juvenile delinquency cases. Statutorily mandated services to children over 10 years of age in child protection cases. And non-mandated services to custodial parents in child protection cases. In our appellate office, we provide the mandated services in criminal appeals, post-conviction proceedings, supervised release proceedings, or what we commonly refer to as parole revocation hearings, and then the sex offender community notification and review hearings. Chairman, as you may recall from last year, in our testimony from last year on the budget, we went into this biennium with a $6.4 million shortfall. Thanks to your efforts, the efforts of this committee, and the folks across the way in the Senate, we did receive some additional funding. We went out, and some of that funding was tied to additional staff positions, additional attorney positions. And we went out and started to hire a few of those folks. At the same time, we were expecting that deficit that we were projecting was going to be made up through attrition and salary savings. And what happened, I think, is what you heard yesterday a little bit from the court, and I'm sure you heard from some of the other folks, and Mr. Chairman, you and I discussed this back in January, is we had salary settlements with state employees that were greater than what any of us had anticipated when we were budgeting and when we were projecting these last spring. So what we saw was basically a Department of Finance projection of personnel cost increases of about 3.5% from the budget last year. The realistic figure when you put in the settlement costs, the health insurance costs, and our mandated retirement costs ended up to be about 6% per year. We took a look at this last fall. We saw that we weren't going to be able to make budget for this year. So we put in a hiring freeze in mid-December. We put a freeze on some contracting for attorneys that we do in some conflict cases, in some unusual cases. At that time, or right shortly after the first of the year, we were facing about a $1.9 million deficit for this year. As of yesterday, we've whittled that down to about a little over $1.6 million, again, through that hiring freeze and taking some of those other actions. We are not asking for additional funding for this year. As Chairman, you and I discussed in January, and for the rest of you, we were going to try to make this work based on what you all did for us last year. We're going to try to make it work for next year as well. That was prior, obviously, to the governor's budget recommendation. Mr. Chairman, if you look at beginning on page 7, just a little bit of an outline of the budget. About 90% of our money or funding goes to district public defense, 7% to the appellate office, and about 3% to administration, our drawer office, where we handle all of that, includes our technology staff and all of those issues. If you look on page 8 of the handout, personnel accounts for about 88% of the budget. Lease is a 3%, mandated costs another 4%. And when I talk about mandated costs, generally those are contractual obligations we have, things like mileage, those kinds of things that aren't directly personnel, but obviously are personnel related. It leaves about 5% of the budget. Most of that, again, are things that are case-driven, things like supplies, you know, those kinds of issues. So there isn't a lot of room for us to go. There's not a lot of places for us to go with a deficit that we have, which is right now projected at about $2 million for next year, and on top of that, a $2.8 million proposed reduction that the governor's got. Let me just address a couple of issues besides that. The natural reaction always is, well, let's cut training, let's cut administration, let's cut infrastructure items. As you can see on the handout, administration is a pretty low piece of our budget. Since I've been in this position, we've reduced our staff in that office, I think, by 3 positions. We're down to, we have 5 people in our tech staff, and I think 6 people other than that. So we have a total of 11 out of the 450 or 430 some full-time equivalents that we have. We can cut training. Sure, we could do that. It's a very minor part of the budget, but you know, several years ago, I was at an employee relations seminar over here on training, and they said the worst thing that could happen, the second worst thing that happens in an organization is you have well-trained employees that leave. The worst thing that you have are you have poorly trained employees that stay. And I think that's true. We found that to be true, and I'm sure most of you, in not only here, but in your other professions, have found the same thing. The other thing that our board has taken a position on is that they are not going to cut infrastructure. As small amount as that is, again, one of the big projects we've got going on right now is the replacement of our law office database, where we track caseload information. You know, how many felonies people are carrying, how many caseloads they're carrying, what kind of time they're putting in. Right now, the redevelopment of that program is trying to interface with NHTSA to save all of our folks a bunch of keystrokes. In other words, that we can bring the data down from the court data, so when we have a client, we can get their name, address, phone number, charge, all of those things from the court, rather than our folks having to key all of that in again. Again, that's one of those issues that, could you save some money on? Yeah, possibly, but boy, in the long run, it sure doesn't make a lot of sense when we then have to have people doing that kind of work. So, really, Mr. Chairman, in short, you know, we're looking at about a $4.8 million problem for next fiscal year. I think that given the steps we've taken this year, I think we're going to make budget. At least that's what my budget person tells me. And I guess the message is we don't have a lot of places to go. I know the court came in and talked to you about mandated services relative to to psychological exams and to some of the other issues they're facing. I would suggest to you that outside of a very small portion of our budget and caseload, all of our stuff, all of the work we do is mandated. So I guess the message here is we don't have a lot of places to go. And I'm not sure that just through attrition we're going to be able to absorb some kind of reduction like that. So, Mr. Chairman, it's very short, but there's not a lot of places for us to go right now. So,
What percentage of attorneys do you contract out for?
Mr. Chairman, it is very minor. I can think of on a regular basis, out of the regular budget, it might be 20 cases a year, maybe. Now, there is a contingency fund that we have access to, which is probably another 20 cases, maybe 15 cases a year. Those are those kind of high-profile, multi-client issues where we have conflicts or there's some major problem to it. We typically, we'll have 12 to 15, maybe 20 at the outside of those cases. So, but it's pretty rare, and becoming more rare, obviously.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll try to be brief, although I will not be representing my specific area of the state or my district if I didn't ask these questions, being a former prosecutor. And this is coming from information I'm receiving from county attorneys and not just my own predecessor who used to work for me. So don't get the idea it's only coming from one person that I'm bringing these questions up. But in the 9th Judicial District, when I first started as county attorney 34 years ago now, District Judge John Rue, who went on to become Judge Rue, was the only assistant public defender representing Roseau County, Kitson County, Warren, Marshall County, Red Lake County, Pennington, and part of Cookston. As of the last count alone in Pennington County, you have 3 full-time persons and 2 part-timers. My office, the county attorney's office in Pennington County, is only 2 people. The Red Lake County attorney is only 1. Kitson's only 1. Marshall County basically has 1. And Roseau has 2, I believe. So, and you have some assistants that are floating around in Roseau and other areas that are part-time or full-time also. My specific question is, why all of a sudden do you have that influx with far more public defenders in my district than we used to, especially in light of the fact that the county attorney's office also has to handle all civil litigation for counties and all sorts of other responsibilities that don't come under your heading, including some tax appeals that once in a while aren't very easy to handle?
Sure. Chairman and Representative Holden. I made a couple of calls last night to folks, because I anticipated this question. The count that they gave me was that they have 4.5 full-time equivalents in the Pennington County and the Thief River Falls office. That office also covers Kitson, Roseau, Marshall, Red Lake, and obviously Pennington County. In those counties, there are, from what they're telling me, 13 prosecutors versus the 4.5 folks that are in their office. Now, we do have a couple of other part-time folks, as you mentioned, in Roseau County. So not only are they don't have as many public defenders as we do prosecutors, but they also, remember, have to travel. I don't know what the distance is from Thief River Falls to Roseau. I would imagine it's got to be at least 80 miles.
63 to be exact.
Okay, somewhere around there. So they're on the road quite a bit. They're also in they're in Roseau, War Road, and all the other towns up there. So that's my answer to your question.
Okay. Now, let me rephrase and point out that a lot of those are part-time city attorneys that aren't full-time prosecutors. To say they're full-time prosecutors, they're not even half-time prosecutors. They're maybe one-eighth or one-quarter-time prosecutors in most of those cases you're referring to, because the 6 I referred to were the direct county attorney's workload. And is it not true that all those city attorneys only handle misdemeanors? In fact, in those districts, that's all they handle, because the gross misdemeanors in many of those counties are handled by the county attorney's offices.
Mr. Kaya.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'll take your word for it that they do. But our folks have to handle the gross misdemeanors, the felonies. the child protection cases and the juvenile cases as well. So whether or not the city attorneys are half-time or three-quarter time, that I couldn't tell you. So
representative.
But then the truth of the matter is, which cases are your far more consuming ones? The misdemeanor cases that routinely are going away in less than a half, couple hours, or the felony cases that the county attorney's offices definitely do have?
Mr. Tyre.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Olin, obviously the misdemeanor cases take less time generally than the felony cases, depending on whether or not the case is going to trial or what's involved in them, but generally speaking, the felony cases take more time.
Okay, one last question while I'm on it. Thank you for your indulgence on these. And the last question is more disturbing to me because it's two last questions, I guess. But procedurally, it's my understanding now that there are two public defenders appearing in some cases in these counties on armed robberies and other cases like that, which there's never going to be two county attorney's office persons in several of those counties, such as Kitson, Red Lake, and Marshall. They wouldn't be the second one to put in the room. So how do we relate that we need two public defenders in some of those cases when there isn't possibly a second county attorney that's even in the county?
Mr.
Chairman and Representative Olin, this is a team approach to defense that we take. In that area of the state where there's a presumptive commit, there are two attorneys on those serious felony cases. Oftentimes, those lawyers have to come from different places. We're talking about those serious cases that go to trial, which is less than 3% of our caseload. The other thing I guess I would suggest to you is a couple of things. One is that we have when it comes to our workforce, inverted bell curve, if you will. We have an awful lot of people who are on this end, kind of senior, if you will, an awful lot of them who are on this end who are young attorneys. I'm sure that you would have liked to have some help on your first few jury trials when you were a young lawyer coming in. Secondly is, as soon as we would have the resources of the police, the BCA, the sheriffs, the crime labs, and all of the other folks that the prosecutors have access to, maybe we wouldn't have two people on these cases, I don't know. We have, if I count right, I think three or four investigators in that district, the size of the state of Indiana in the 9th Judicial District. That's all these folks have to rely on, is those investigators. If we have a serious case with DNA expertise, or if we have a serious case with forensics, yes, we can call expert witnesses, but to sift through all of that, that's going to be the attorney's job. And so that's the answer to your question.
Thank you. And I realize that those are going to be the answers, but still, it doesn't answer the fact how you have two people sitting at in a trial when the county attorney's office only has one person who's probably paid less in some of those counties than either one of the two that are sitting in that trial. Because these full-time county attorneys up there, and some cases part-time county attorneys, aren't exactly making the world's greatest salaries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question pertains to the public defense itself. And, you know, we've heard testimony from the other courts on how they're going to have to let staff go. But the public defender's office is one of the largest systems of public defense, especially to low-income and people that need public defense. What do you see in the future as far as, and probably in the past, as far as estimation of caseloads that you're going to have if you're going to have to cut staff?
Mr. Carr.
Mr. Chairman and members, it's a good question. Right now our caseloads, our folks carry about roughly 175% of the caseload standard that we have. Right now we're working on, obviously, scenarios for next year in terms of what happens if, depending on, you know, what you all do, what the governor's recommendations, you know, ultimately end up being, or what the budget ends up being. Those caseloads will obviously will go up. either we do it, we lose people through attrition, or we end up losing people that we end up having to go through some kind of layoff process. We're very concerned about that. I don't think you can ask folks to continue to carry those kind of caseloads and those kind of time commitments, in particular our part-time defenders. I think most of you were here last year when I testified. Our part-time defenders right now put in about 40,000 extra hours a year that they don't get paid for. I'm just not sure that we can ask them to continue to put in those hours or more hours, if we have fewer defenders. But that's ultimately going to be the what happens.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Perry, I have just a couple questions, and if you've already given this information, forgive me, but my mind was wandering a little bit because I was looking at your handout, and most of the stuff we get, all of the stuff we get here at the committee level is on pretty thin paper and in black and white, and I noticed this is in color, and it's really smooth, high-quality paper, so my mind may have wandered a little bit. So how many attorneys are hired in the PD office statewide?
Mr. Chairman, how many are we? Do we hire?
Hire. How many
every year?
Mr. Chairman, yes, Mr. Carr. How many attorneys, on an average basis, are working in the PD on the PD staff?
Okay. How many we hire a year, or how many we actually have? I guess
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carr, whatever way you want to answer.
Okay. Right now, Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, right now we have roughly 430 full-time equivalents. Again, because about half the staff is part-time, so in terms of numbers of lawyers, it might be over around 600.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Tyler, then what is the average number of cases each FTE handled? What is the caseload?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, right now the average full-time equivalent handles roughly 700 case units. Remember, when we talk about case units, we talk about that's roughly the equivalent of a misdemeanor based on our weighted caseload formula. And again, since most of our lawyers handle a variety of cases. They're not just doing misdemeanors or felonies or whatever. Particularly if you get outside the metro area, they have to handle a variety of cases.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kier, how does that rank in comparison to the other states as far as, I guess, two parts to the question. We have roughly 5 million folks in the state, so we have 430 FTEs, 600, I heard the numbers well, but 430 FTEs on the public defenders. How do we rank compared to the other states in the public defender FTEs per population?
Mr. Carr.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I'm not sure I've got that information. We can see if we can find it. Again, there is a little bit of a difference depending on what cases are charged out and how many, there's different systems in every state, but we can certainly try to find that for you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it would be good information to have before we conclude our business, just to see how we rank in this state compared to others. If we're average, if we have a whole lot more than other states or less, that would be good information to know. Does your office or do your public defenders handle any cases that are not assigned to you by a judge?
Mr. Carr.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, not that I'm aware of. I guess just to give an example of the assignments come from the bench, so I can't imagine that there are any.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, that's all for now. Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell us, Mr. Carter, what is the total budget of the board?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, for this year it's just over $66
million. Representative Eastland.
And when we're talking about staff, just to get an idea, because I mean that seems to be where you see the cuts have to come from. What portion of the budget is actually salaries and benefits and that kind of information?
Sure. Chairman and members and Representative Eastman, if you look on page 8 of the handout, personnel represents about 88% of the budget.
And then one other question, Mr. Chair. You talked about different kinds of mandated services, constitutionally mandated, statutorily mandated, and then other services you provide pro bono. I don't know how that happens, but what portion of your budget deals with constitutionally and statutorily mandated? Let me separate the two if you've got that. The constitutionally mandated services and the statutorily mandated.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastwood, about 5% of the budget, or I should say this, let me back up, about 5% of the caseload is our non-mandated services. That's the child protection cases where we represent parents. We are not statutorily obligated to do that work, and that's got a long history, and some of you know more about that than you care to. That's about 5% of the total caseload. When you transfer that into workload, case units, it's roughly, the total child protection area is about 12% of the workload. Parents make up a majority of that work because we also include the children in there. We're representing kids over 10 there too. So, but just that alone, my guess would be, if I had to guess, breaking out the parent piece of that, the non-mandated piece, you know, from a caseload standpoint, it's probably 3 or 4% of the cases that are parents and child protection cases, and maybe 10% of the workload or of our total workload, something like that.
And what about the constitutionally mandated versus statutory?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Eastland, I'd have to take a look at that. Obviously all of the criminal work or most of the criminal work is constitutionally mandated. More of the statutorily mandated might be in the appellate section, but even there I think there's some case law that would probably tell us that it's constitutionally mandated as well as statutorily mandated. But
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carr, when you divide your budget up of $56 million and you take it over these 10 districts, how does that get dispersed? Do you do that according to population, crime rate, need, or
Mr. Carr?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hawk, basically what we do is we look at, there are four things we're supposed to look at that are in the statute. The biggest one, obviously, is caseload. Where are the cases occurring? One of the things the board has made some very big strides in with the help of the legislature over the last several years is to even those caseloads out across the state so that we are providing the same kind of service in Representative Orland's district than we are in yours, that folks aren't, carrying more cases in one area of the state. Obviously, we can't always keep that up because you're here every 2 years with a budget and, crime doesn't take a holiday, and wait for the legislature to decide what they're going to do with the budget. But that's basically what we do. What we did last year and what we have done in the last couple of years as we've had some budget difficulties is we budget the non-personnel items first and say what are kind of our fixed costs. What we have done is usually budget those 2 years behind. So, for example, this year, we told our districts, you're only getting money in those line items based on your 2006 budget. You're not getting inflation. You're not getting anything else. Now, the exception to that is rent or, mileage, those things that, again, we're contractually obligated for. After that, then that's when we disperse it to the personnel side. And then we work on it from there. And folks have to try to bring the budget into balance.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Carson, do you have in these 10 districts some best practices that some districts are doing better than other districts?
Mr. Carr.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hawes, the problem that we have is all of the work that we do is, and the best practices, if you will, are really dictated by the court. We're kind of, if you think of it, the criminal justice system as a we're kind of at the bottom of the funnel. And, for example, in the 6th Judicial District up in the northeastern Minnesota, motion practice up there is all written up. Our folks have to submit written briefs. I believe maybe in Representative Olin's district, they probably not do a lot of that over in the northwestern part of the state. In a number of counties in central Minnesota, if you go to Aiken County, you go to Crow Wing County, you go to places like that, for example, a driving after suspension, you may get jail time, you may get a hefty fine there. So there are some issues related there that take up some time. You come to the metropolitan area, you go into Hennepin or Ramsey County, those usually are payable. So they're usually you pay a fine and you move on. So the best practice is really, if you will, again, ended up dictating by the court how many appearances there are, whether or not you have to file written motions versus making oral motions, those kinds of things. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to try it one more time. And not for your answer. I'm getting at. If, in fact, we were giving you increases, would you spread that increase throughout your system equally? And we're not doing that. You understand? Because we have a deficit.
Mm-hmm.
So my reverse question is, my converse question is, if there was an across-the-board cut, would you disperse that across-the-board equally through those 10, or would there be areas that you think could be do with less or have done with less before?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hawes, that's a board decision. I don't make that decision, our board does, but I will tell you what they have done in the past, and I have no reason to believe they wouldn't do it again. They will look again at those caseloads and see where the caseloads are.
Okay.
And that's how they will decide what, who gets either who gets more money or who gets less money.
Mr. Chair, committee members, what often happens in government is when somebody's doing a really good job, they actually get punished for that. And those that have been doing the least amount of efficiency have the most amount of waste and can take a little bit more cut. So when those come across, I think, they should be established more analytically than they are arithmetically. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And these are just comments, and I'm not going to take a lot of time here. The first comment would be that, as I've indicated, some of those county attorneys are part-time that I'm referring to, and I would guess their workload compared to a city attorney's office is probably 80% plus out of that 100% he's referring to when he says 13. So basically there's 6 doing probably well over 80% of that work. The next comment that I would make, and this one I'm going to do just the opposite of what I have been doing up till now, the public defenders have been serving a good purpose up in the northwest corner on one thing. As in the child protection area, I would tend to agree with him. They are handling cases that they don't need to necessarily handle. And if they weren't handling those cases, our counties that couldn't afford them would be stuck with them. So on that, I do have to acknowledge that his percent is probably close to right on those child protection instances. And they are serving the purpose for some to the counties on some extent to that.
Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carr, I don't think that you were here yesterday, but I know Mr. Ellingson was. And in the discussion, our prosecutors on the committee indicated that the public defenders were being, the courts were ordering public defense for people that were making more money than probably the public defender was getting and certainly the prosecutors were getting. And I didn't quite understand how it sounded to me from what they were saying was that the people that were ordered to have public defenders could well pay for their own attorney. Is that the case across the state?
The chairman and Representative Murphy, I believe there are some instances where folks don't qualify to receive a public defender. That's probably going on. I would suggest to you that it's less so than I think folks would have like to believe. I think we always hear the kind of the horror story, if you will, and we've had a few of those. We've had a couple down in Dakota County. We've had one down in Waseca County where we had some folks who were obviously well-to-do or could afford to hire their own lawyer. When those are obvious ones in front of us, we try to get out of that representation. We've actually taken a couple of cases to the Court of Appeals to get, you know, off of those representation of those cases. The other thing I think that happens quite a bit, or I shouldn't say quite a bit, but it happens more so in the outlying areas of greater Minnesota, is you got folks who are probably employed but are not making a lot of money, and if any of you have tried to hire a lawyer lately, a private attorney lately, it's not cheap. And in the criminal practice, what generally happens is folks want their retainer up front. You're accused of a DWI or you're accused of some major crime, a private lawyer is going to want anywhere from $3,000 or $4,000 up to $10,000 or more up front, because they know if you get convicted, there's no way they're going to get their money. So I don't know, you know, if any of us were accused of a major felony, if we had $10,000 to pluck down right off the bat to get a private lawyer, especially if you're, you know, making $20,000 a year or $25,000 a year. So is there some of that that goes on? I think there's some of that that goes on. Is it a major issue? I depends on what part of the state you're in, and I just don't think it's a major issue. For example, here in Ramsey County, we have Criminal Defense Services Incorporated, which is a group of private lawyers that have agreed to take some of these cases at reduced cost. And so they take a lot of those borderline cases. We actually provide some office space for them so that they have some place for their the administration of that and the file, so that, because it's obviously helpful for us to not have to take those cases. So,
Mr. Chair, does the court sit down and talk to you, talk to the Board of Public Defense or to the chief public defenders across the state about the people that they are assigning? Or what kind of means tests do the courts give, in your opinion?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, there's a couple of things that go on. First of all, is the state public defenders were charged with coming up with the forms for looking at eligibility. And we've done that. State public defenders done that, distributed that to all of the judges in the state, all of the courthouses. Whether or not that's followed and how it's followed, obviously we have 285 district court judges that you know all have their own independent mind about how that works and what to do. I will tell you that our chief public defenders, as they meet with their chief judges, as they go to their judges meetings, they continually bring this issue up and talk to those judges about that, because it does tend to lapse sometimes, I think. Especially when you handle as many cases as everybody's handling, it is sometimes easier to, you know, you want the cases to keep moving. So, but we are in discussions with the judges at all times about that.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Carr, is that a determination of the judges or the court administrators of whether someone will receive a public defender?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, it varies across the state, you know. You know, depending on what courthouse you're in. Generally, as I understand it, and when I've been in, you know, visiting courtrooms, it's a lot of times it's court administration, you know. But the judges, you know, depending again what kind of part of the state you're in, the judges will be, obviously review that. So.
We have Representative Haas, Bigham, and Lashin, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you.
just very quickly, in these times of deficit, there is also an opportunity to do things that are not very politically accepted when you have dollars, such as switching any mandates, rules, regulations, all those types of things. And when there is a time of necessity, the political will gets a little stronger to making those corrections. So I would encourage people that are under that to ask for moratoriums or reduction or efficiencies in those mandates. Those, some of the ugliest things that you didn't think you could ever bring up before because you were going to be beaten publicly, of which I've brought three or four up since here, and I'm healing up. I'll start them again sometime. But I think now is the time to go back and look at a few of those items and say, you know, this really is something that's not necessary. Our audits are running into each other. You know, this year audit running into the next year audit or whatever those happens to be, your maintenance of effort standards. So I think it's also time to take a look at a few of those and bring a couple of those forward just to get it off the books. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that I have is, what recourse would the board have or the courts have if it is discovered that somebody, you know, really probably shouldn't have been eligible for a public defender? And I guess, what is the process for your board specifically for those recourses? Can you challenge it, or can you, you know, bring it up with a judge or something?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Biggin, again, the determination of eligibility is done by the court, either the judge or court administration, generally, you know, one of those two. Where we have cases where there is an obvious somebody doesn't qualify, we have challenged those in the past. And again, as I don't know if you were in the room when I mentioned this, we've had a few of those. So again, we hear the horror stories, and you know, everybody does, of, you know, the airline pilot in Dakota County that, you know, maybe got a public defender, or, you know, we had a case down in Waseca County where somebody owned a farm free and clear and had, you know, X number of $1,000 in the bank, and they were allowed a public defender. That particular case we challenged. We said, you know what, we don't think this person should qualify. It's a very tricky line, because the individual lawyer who's on the case has the conflict of interest then. I mean, if you're now saying, well, this person doesn't qualify, and then you end up with them, how do you represent that person? Generally, what we do is, if there's an obvious case, we kick it up to our managing attorney or our chief public defender, who then takes it to the court to say, listen, we think you ought to review this again. And if they are not willing to review it again, as I said earlier, there are some cases where we've taken it to the Court of Appeals and said, you know what, this person really shouldn't be allowed a public defender. The problem with that process is, by the time that you do that, a lot of times the case has already moved down the track and maybe it's already been resolved. So, but we do that, and we do look for that. So.
And last, and then we'll have Representative Smith will be the final.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is part of the reason we're having this discussion. What you just heard in the answers to the questions is why I think this discussion was more properly had yesterday. Because as Mr. Kyder stated, it's the court that appoints the public defender. And they, public defenders have a certain role in it, of course, in that they can see the guy rolls up in a $60,000 Escalade and he owns it and everything else, and he qualifies for public defenders. One example I'll give, where I was in court, this was probably 3-4 months ago, where I was a DWI because the guy met an inspector at one of his rental properties, and the inspector saw that the guy showed up drunk, and he said, I'm not going to do an inspection on your duplex when you're drunk. We'll reschedule it. The guy's like, okay, and stumbles back to his car, gets in and drives back to his home that he owns. Well, he shows up in morning arraignment with a public defender, and I said, Your Honor, at the end of it, this is kind of ridiculous. The guy owns several rental properties in his own home. He's got an expensive car, and yet here he is with a public defender. And he pled guilty, which we got rid of it. That was fine. But I said, one of my requests was that restitution be given to the public defender. Now, people may remember that up until last year, that was capped out at $40 an hour. for in law, which I think that was changed last year, wasn't it, Mr. Carr? So we changed that, which is good. Nonetheless, if this guy actually paid what he should have, he'd have been putting $5,000 down up front for someone who would have done the same thing. So I said to the judge after the plea, I want restitution as one of the conditions of the plea. Well, the judge said, you know, I'll look at this, but upon checking, she said, I talked with Mr. Hankus about this in the past. We have no capacity in the public defender's office to accept a check from this guy. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. So he's just going to walk on this and essentially use up resources that other truly indigent people don't get. And she said, yeah, essentially. So I would ask, and this isn't a question you need to respond right away, Mr. Kaya, but I would ask that there is some resource for that. The other option I asked of the judge was that we'll just give the guy a higher fine or something. At a certain point, it's just a matter of justice. And that didn't happen. And this does happen sometimes. I do think, though, that Mr. Kaya speculated on this. I don't think that the market rate, the current market rate for a defense attorney at DWI is properly the prerogative of the public defender. You know, I mean, there is a philosophical difference here that Representative Liebling and I discussed yesterday about whether we should just give everyone a free attorney. And there are a lot of people, I think, who sort of believe that. But if we're going to move in that direction in the courts, because it's kind of happening right now, I mean, to a certain extent, we need to have the discussion, I think, here in this body. But I would ask, at least in the future, that there be some capacity by which restitution can be sent to the public defender when that happens, because it's your attorneys who spot this and then point it out.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'll certainly look into that one, but we have reimbursement come to public defenders all the time across the state, so I'm a little confused as to what the issue is in terms of capacity. We can't receive it directly. I'm not sure we have access, but we have reimbursements. Public defender reimbursements are a regular thing, especially as you get outside of the metropolitan area, and as this body knows, because we've talked about it before, those reimbursements go back to part-time public defenders to help defray the cost of their overhead. And I think you got that report, at least the chair did, in January. So I'd like to talk to you a little more about it, because there shouldn't be any reason why it shouldn't work, because it works in everywhere else.
President Smith, is yours to this point, or is it something different? Because that's been Liebling.
Different.
That's been Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just since Representative Bless's comment somewhat included me, I just feel a little bit compelled to respond. Representative Bless, I actually didn't think that was our discussion. I mean, I was not advocating, and I hope this is clear, I was not advocating that everybody should have a public defender. I certainly was not. I thought that the discussion was more about whether people having attorneys slows down the system and therefore creates costs. That was what my comments yesterday were directed to, and I just wanted to clear that up.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. One question, Mr. Carr. I've heard you testify that you've gone into court challenging being appointed when you thought the person was overqualified or could hire their own attorney, had the means to do so. Have you ever gone in and challenged a judge as not appointing you where you think you should have been appointed as a TD?
Mr. Carr.
Chairman, Representative Smith, we didn't get appointed and we think we should have.
In other words, yes, Mr. No. Chairman, have you gone out looking for work?
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, no.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on. Thank you, Mr. Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I need a motion, members, to approve the minutes of March 12th.
So moved.
Ms. Haas moves the minutes of March 12th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Now we'll hear from Civil Legal Services, Mr. Beneke and Mr. Lane. Mr. Beneke, Mr. Lane, if you could keep your, I'm sorry, we're going, we started late and we're a little late now. If you could keep your presentation to about 10 minutes, and so we can have 10-15 minutes to ask questions.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity, and I certainly will try to be brief. My name for the record is Bruce Beneke. I'm the former director of Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, and now it's senior counsel. And to my right is Jerry Lane. We've worked together both in for 38 years, and he's the director of the program that covers mid-Minnesota legal assistance in the central part of the state, and he has served with distinction. Both Jerry and I are here representing the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition, which is the statewide network of legal aid programs that work in all 87 counties. And our role, as you know, as legal aid attorneys, our role is to help advance the core value of our state to provide access to justice for persons. And our job is to provide that meaningful access to justice in civil cases. We are very grateful in the coalition for the strong tradition of bipartisan support in the legislature the past 26 years for legal aid funding. We're grateful to this committee and to your counterparts in the Senate. Many of you have been very supportive and helpful on equal justice and access to justice and legal aid issues over the years. And we're very grateful of that tradition. We also appreciate being part of the court's budget. They have been a very important part of the justice partnership in Minnesota in supporting us, and also very thankful to the Bar Association, the private lawyers, and in addition to the bipartisan legislature, as we try to deliver services and we believe do a good job on a statewide basis. What I'd like to do today is very briefly mention what we requested last year, talk a little bit about how we spent the money that you gave us, and then make a question, a comment or two about impact, and then open up for questions. And because I realize you've got a very difficult task, and it's more fun in years where there's money, but nonetheless, this is a very important inquiry that you've got to make as you face so many important decisions about good programs everywhere. Last year, we presented to you a request for a $2 million a year increase in our base from $12.3 million to $14.3 million. We're very grateful that you granted us nearly half of that request, or $1 million a year. And we were in the base until the last moment when there was some unexpected projections which caused legal aid funding to be one time. Nonetheless, we're grateful for that one-time funding. And what we've tried to do with that additional money is that we've tried to address emerging critical needs in the community. And we've not only tried to do it by hiring additional staff or retaining staff where we lost other sources of funding, but we've also leveraged local resources and federal resources, as well as volunteer time. Perhaps the biggest area of emerging need that we've been able to be helpful to is the whole area of mortgage foreclosure and predatory lending. With the state's investment last year, we've been able to hire additional staff and to train that staff. We're able to represent individuals, both homeowners and tenants, faced with mortgage foreclosure. We've been able to stop the mortgage foreclosures. We've been able to negotiate. We've also, again, brought in volunteer attorneys and trained them to help us with mortgage foreclosure cases, which are very complex and very time-consuming. We've also worked to train mortgage counselors and others out in the community so that they recognize legal problems quickly and get them to us in time to do something about mortgage foreclosures. So we're really grateful for the increase because it's helped in that area. Another area, which is mentioned in the materials, and I won't elaborate, and you can look at them, but we've also been able to help with other problems that have been resulting from the economic downturn. We've been able to assist persons who have lost their jobs, persons facing credit management kinds of problems, and we work extensively both through legal representation and community education, helping seniors with identity theft kinds of problems. And again, we've leveraged both government and corporate and private attorneys in that effort. Another area that we've been able to address for the funds, though much more needs to be done, is the whole area of reentry. We have been able to represent a number of persons who have been unfairly denied licenses for PCAs or for daycare centers or other kinds of jobs that give them gainful employment. We've been able to represent people within the law of expunging criminal records expunging landlord-tenant records, giving persons an opportunity both to get a job and or to stay in housing. In addition to all of that work, as I'll talk about in a minute, we've been able to maintain our normal caseload. As some of you will recall, back in the early part of this decade, legal aid suffered a 20% cut in federal, state, and local funding, and our staff statewide went down from 179 FTE attorney positions all the way down to 135 positions. We've gradually built our way back, again with your support and with the support of others in the community, and with the additional one-time funds you gave us last year, we were able to get back up to 170 legal aid attorneys statewide. So we're almost not quite back to where we were in 2001, but we're very grateful for the support, and we're very proud of our staff. The staff that we hire come to legal aid with very, very great dedication to providing Minnesotans with access to justice. In most parts of the state, legal aid starting salary is $39,000. They bring the same law school debt to the table as all other kinds of lawyers do. And we're very proud of our retention rate in civil legal services, because despite our low salaries, people stay for a long time, and I think that's emblematic of the dedication and the excellence of their work. Another thing that your funding last year has helped us to do is to hold on to some positions that would have been lost due to cuts in federal funding, and also it's enabled us to hire a more diverse staff, and diverse not only in terms of cultural background and ethnicity, but also language, as the court testified yesterday about the great need for interpreters. I'm really proud that this funding has allowed us to hire additional Somali, Hmong, Hispanic lawyers and screening staff so that we can provide greater access to all Minnesotans who are in need of legal services in civil cases. Your funding also has allowed us to continue our work in other areas. Our biggest area of practice is domestic abuse and complex family law. Another major area that we practice in is seniors. Also, we help a lot with needs-based benefit programs, Social Security, and that kind of thing. In addition to the mortgage foreclosure and predatory lending work that we've been able to do, we continue our strong work trying to prevent homelessness, also preventing housing discrimination, and using the legal process to keep to prepare properties so that they remain affordable and on the market, so that there is low-income housing available. We also work to help families become citizens or naturalized, and we hope in a host of other areas, including helping the disabled and seniors and others gain access to health care. And in many of these areas, we save the state money, and we also help to make the courts work more efficiently, saving money. And the thing that, while we don't have the final statistics in, and I can get them for you as the session progresses, I looked at our own program statistics yesterday for 2007, covering 32 counties of southern Minnesota, and thanks to your support, we were able to increase our caseload by 8.6% last year in the southern part, which covers about 37% of state population, and as soon as I get the data from other programs, I can share that. So thank you again. We're very grateful. Your investment has allowed us, I think, to do a lot of good things, and particularly, as you all know, when there's an economic downturn, there are more social and legal kinds of problems, and the funding that you've given us, not only do we see more problems and does the caseload go up, but you've allowed us to respond to that, and every time we can help a family facing a mortgage foreclosure or credit problems or job loss or other kind of thing, we can help families through crisis situations, we can stabilize them, and in doing that, I think that our work really makes us, give legal aid a role in any strategy that the legislature might have as part of dealing with the economic downturn. I think that we have an important role to help in that. With respect to impact, I would just say that, you know, like the court, like the public defenders, most of our costs are personnel, any cut that you would make, something that I would encourage you to look at as we go forward is that the cut that's proposed may be a little higher than it should be, because it's not only on our base, but also on one time. The other thing I would encourage you to think about is our circumstances are a little bit unique, both in terms of the special role that legal aid plays when there are more cases coming as an economic downturn and how we can help with that economic downturn. But our circumstances are a little bit unique in that next year we will not only how you finally make your final decisions. If there's a base cut, we will have that as well as losing the one-time money. So we can argue a little bit that it's a little bit of a double whammy for legal aid. But having said that, you've been very supportive. We're very grateful. There is still a very large unmet need for legal services. We really respect all the hard decisions that you have to make, and we're happy to provide you any information that we might be able to provide you. And we really look forward to continuing our justice partnership and working with you to provide equal access and access to justice for all Minnesotans. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
Mr. Vanek,
did I make it?
You did. How many new attorneys did you say that you hired?
Mr. Chairman, we were able to both retain some positions because of the federal cutback and Department of Justice and HUD funds, but we were also able to add 5.5 attorney positions, and probably some support staff along with that, but most of the money went into adding some new attorney positions and retaining positions, attorney positions that we might have otherwise have lost.
So you were cognizant of the fact that that was one-time money, unfortunately, that we provided for these when you made these hires.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, we were cognizant. We certainly explained that to people, but we try to operate on the philosophy as best we can to get the money out there. There's so great an unmet need to meet as much of that need as we can in the short term, even if it means 2 years down the line that we might be faced with a cutback. And so you're right. I mean, you're very fair to us, and we try to be fair to people who come on board, tell them their eyes are wide open that this is one-time money and there might be a future cut.
Representative Muller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, Mr. Beneke, I'm glad to see you're still alive. I heard about your birthday party.
Was it worse?
You can still talk till everybody's asleep. No wrong to remember what you're up to. But seriously, I thought that the Volunteer Lawyers Network in Minneapolis, for instance, you talked about the foreclosure crisis, and Dario Bannon, of course, did a huge job in Hennepin County on that. I thought that was through the VLN, and I thought that was Bar Association fund. The same with Patty Murdo's program up in Duluth. I thought that was used to be Bar Association funded, I thought. That's what she used to tell me.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I've been boring Representative Mulley ever since we went to law school together. It's a partnership. As I mentioned earlier, most of what we do with legal aid is we try to leverage volunteer time in addition to staff time. In Smills, what we did is we hired an attorney away from a large law firm in Minneapolis, trained him in on mortgage foreclosure, and set him out to recruit lawyers and to work with Mr. Lane's program, with BLN and others. Secondly, BLN and Pat, Ms. Murto's program in Duluth also receive state money. So they're not just volunteer. But Mr. Lane's, I would like to have him talk, because he's from Hennepin County. But Mr. Lane's program, working in partnership with BLN, working with Smills, and working with the other legal aid providers in the state, has increased our capacity, and Mr. Lane's work has also addressed the needs of mortgage foreclosure issues on more of a statewide basis. So we do work with them. We're all in this together. We all help. But I'd like to have Mr. Lane talk a little bit about the special relationship with BLN and Hennepin County.
Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, my name is Jody Lane. I'm the Executive Director at Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance, which serves Hennepin County and 19 surrounding counties in central Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, we do, as Bruce noted, work with Volunteer Lawyers Network. In fact, I was over at Hennepin County at a board meeting the other day because we have a small contract with the county to help supplement the funding we receive here, specifically to do housing court work. And Volunteer Lawyers Network was there to say to the county board members they could not do what they do without us beside them. We have the people with 20 years experience to train their volunteers. We're very happy that some of, especially the newer lawyers in the big firms, are willing and encouraged by their friends to volunteer time. They need us to train them. They need us there
to answer the questions that come up over at the courthouse when they are seeing a client, and it's a situation they've never seen before. They need us to provide the backup and the consultation, and what they said in the county was they could not do what they do unless we were doing it with them. So it really is a partnership that's very cost effective, because their willingness combined with our experience, it's a very potent combination. And I would note also that partnership pays off in other ways, because we have been able to do work in the mortgage foreclosure area. We were approached about 6 months ago by a foundation saying we want to put money into working with tenants who are caught in the middle of these mortgage foreclosures and don't know where to turn and don't know what's happening to them. And we worked with that foundation. We got some foundation money, some county money, specifically to serve the tenants who are caught in the middle, who haven't done anything wrong, and suddenly face the loss of their housing in these mortgage foreclosure situations. So it's a partnership. It's cost effective. It's very leveraged.
Mr. Chair, Paul, I'm trying to think of Paul. He does a lot of tenant work in Hennepin County, but he's
Paul Burnburn, the homeowner.
Pretty Burnburn. I had it a little wrong. That group he's with now, who funds them then?
A combination of private and county money, I believe. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mallory. He also works with us and depends on us, and there are referrals back and forth. We try to be very cost-effective and avoid duplication of services. His program is largely focused on the suburban area, whereas much of our work is focused inside the city of Minneapolis, although we do some crossover work.
Just one follow-up. Isn't I thought DLN was funded. Isn't that funded by the Bar Association or not?
Mr. Ryan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, the answer is yes. They receive a substantial part of their funding from the Hennepin County Bar Association. It's not enough to do all the work that needs to be done. They do, as Mr. Beneke noted, receive some funding through the state appropriation process.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. Back here. Well, thank you for your question.
Mr. Chair, I can just one footnote. We are like the Fram oil filter ad. You could cut legal aid. There's no constitutional mandate yet, but those costs will simply show up somewhere else. They'll show up in the court system in terms of unrepresented litigants clogging up the courts. They will show up at the homeless shelters, which tax funds support. It's the people we don't see that wind up in the shelters, costing the taxpayers a lot of money, and then winding up on tenant screening blacklists so that they can't get housing, even when they're looking for it.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members, we're very grateful for the time and for all of your support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from the Department of Human Rights. Commissioner, we did have a lengthy presentation by the department relative to the survey, so I guess maybe if you could just keep your comments sort of directed to what the governor's recommendations, the impact of the governor's recommendations on the department, so we can try to get out of here by 25-2 maybe.
Thank you, Representative Tamar. Good morning, committee members. We will be very brief. Once again, my name is Del McCorbel. I'm the commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Here this morning with Deputy Commissioner Fitzpatrick, who's also our budget director. And we'll talk briefly about the proposed recommendation to cut 4% from the department's budget. Just by way of a refresher, the department handles three primary program areas: case processing, and last year we handled about 15,000 contacts, which resulted in about 1,000 charges of discrimination being investigated. We handle a contractor compliance program, or any state contractor that has a contract in excess of $100,000. Needs to have an approved affirmative action plan, and we're the department that certifies those plans. And last year we were monitoring about 1,500 certified contractors. And then we conduct outreach and education using various events, activities, and methods to get the word out to people about what their rights and responsibilities are under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And I am not here to talk about the numbers specifically. Deputy Commissioner Kirkpatrick is going to do that. But I just wanted to just note that as a commissioner of the Department of Human Rights, you know, I feel very responsible for leaving the department in better shape than I found it. And I'm very concerned at this point with regard to the, you know, perpetual cuts to the department's budget, because we are right now at a tipping point, I believe, with regard to our means to reach the statutory mandates that we report to the legislature on every 6 months, and that's the 365-day deadlines, the 180-day deadlines for non-complex cases. I'm very concerned because, as Deputy Commissioner Kirkpatrick will explain, any cut to this program now comes straight out of the labor account, and complaint investigation is a very labor-intensive process. We've started right now to look at staffing, identify who might be retiring, who might be taking leaves of absences, et cetera, just to avert layoffs. And I'm also sure that you're aware that we're also in a hiring freeze at this point. So if we are talking about cutting the budget, no, everybody is. I'm not, you know, unrealistic in knowing that we're at a very critical stage in the, you know, economy of this state and what needs to happen. But I do just want to go on the record that I am very concerned at the sustained decreases to the budget, and it is again we are at a tipping point, I believe.
Mr. Kirkpatrick.
Yes, Deputy Kirkpatrick, sir, I'd like to bring up the fact that currently this year our payroll is 86% of our budget, and it should be a two-sheet tables that were handed out. At the conclusion of this year and the beginning of next year, that 86% will move to 91%, which is a combination of the reduction and the increase for the returning staff. That will put us in great danger because we will have to realize a 2 to 2.5 FTE decrease next year. On the second sheet, if you would look at, we currently have dropped and we anticipate at this closing out this year at 41.2 FTEs. And the critical area that we are worried about is our caseloads, where our active caseload will rise from a traditional 25 active cases per investigator to 32 cases per investigator. What that will mean is the cases will take longer, and it will be almost impossible for us to reach that 365-day requirement.
I have a question about the appropriation that we made last year, the $1.4 million to replace the department's case managing tracking system. What is the status of that currently? How much money have you expended?
Mr. Chairman, currently we are in the midst of ensuring that we want to make sure we do this right. So we've got all of our requirements. We hope to have our request for proposal on the street, the middle of April. And so currently we've gone out and hired a project manager, and he is helping us in the design of the system.
What would happen, Mr. Kirkpatrick, if we delayed, or if could you delay that project?
Based on funding, yes, we could delay it. What would happen? It would make it even more difficult for us to attain the statutory limits. It would require us to continue to do business as we do it, which unfortunately is becoming more and more difficult with the lack of staff. We also reserve that money off, so we're not using any of that for operational. So the operational side would stay, and our productivity, which we hope to improve with the use of that money, would not happen. That's true.
And Deputy Commissioner, Commissioner, can you tell me how many full-time employees you have in your management services and administration unit?
Representative Chairman Paymar, committee members, in management service and administration, we have a four-member leadership team, which consists of myself and the deputy commissioner, an individual who manages the administration and fiscal services, and a manager who handles the education and outreach program.
And Commissioner, the governor is recommending that you, I mean, if this recommendation was also to be agreed to by this committee, that you lay off staff. Would this include individuals from the Management Services and Administration Unit?
Representative Paymar, we'd have to look at potential layoffs within every bargaining unit and every compensation plan. And when we did this in 2003, that's exactly what we had to do to make a series of layoffs fair. We did look at layoffs across the bargaining units. I do want to point out, though, that we had some attrition in the management services and administration group about 5 months ago. So we did lose our legal person. You recall Linda Hansen did that job in the past. She's no longer with the organization, so we were fortunate enough to be able to hire another person, less a salary, a few less responsibilities, to be able to realize some savings from that resignation.
So, Commissioner, that meant, so you're saying you had five in that division?
And now we have four, yes.
In the budget that you presented to this committee, it says you had 12.9 FTEs in management services and administration. Is there, why the difference?
Sure, they're not all managers. Some of them are in the MAIT bargaining unit. They are attorneys who handle administrative appeals. They are individuals who handle some of the education and outreach, but they're not all in the management bargaining unit or compensation plan.
Are there any questions from members? Anything else you'd like to add, Commissioner?
I think we've, in our three times here this session, we've probably laid it all out there as well as we can, but thank you for having us again.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. What time are we meeting tomorrow? We're meeting at 1 o'clock in room 500 south for a number of bills. There's nothing else before this committee. We're adjourned.